This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Top banks here are expected to dole out $36 billion in bonuses this year. That's a 20% increase from 2005. Top of the list, Goldman Sachs, with quarterly profits up 93%. The company will distribute a record high $16.5 billion in compensation.
I'd say have your children grow up to be investment bankers.
Try, you can refinance your home in the blink of an eye, but if you fall behind and you just can't pay, the bank is gonna take your home away, cause they're predators, predators, they keep devouring more and more, they're predators, predators, they're getting richer by preying on the poor.
So the people who get to use the money first, which is created by the Federal Reserve System, benefit. So the money gravitates to the banks and to Wall Street. So that's why you have more billionaires than ever before.
You know, when you really get down to it, one of the things we've really seen in the last 10 years is simply a huge swindle.
And while they celebrated, their world was beginning to fall apart.
Hello, I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I've got two tasty speeches for you on why billionaires are taking over and what we can do about it. A quick note about this week's program. More than half of Radio EcoShock listeners are American, although we have people grabbing the podcast from all over the English-speaking world and beyond. Hello, Britain. Hello, Australia and Switzerland and all of the other countries. Our topic this week, a new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. You'll hear directly from the authors, tax professor Neil Brooks and journalist Linda McQuaig. Some of the following speech is about Canada, but wait. Most of the examples of billionaires and studies of what people really want are American. You'll hear plenty about Wall Street, the greedy hedge funders, and why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his billions. That is because many developed nations suffer the same disease. A collection of billionaires have taken over the financial system, the political system, and social discourse via the mainstream media, which they also happen to own. As we'll hear, it's an unannounced coup. Welcome to the plutocracy, where democracy used to be. You'll also hear how other countries, like Sweden, deal with the same problems much better to create a fair society. Horrors! The event at the Vancouver Public Library, November 2, 2010, was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. This recording is by me, Alex Smith, of Radio EcoShock. Here is Neil Brooks, for 35 years a professor of tax law at the University of Toronto and co-author of the book, The Trouble with Billionaires. We tune in partway as Neil outlines the seven premises of the new book.
Here's the seven premises that underlie the book. And incidentally, if you accept these premises, then you have to accept our conclusion. So what I'm going to do is just go through each one, and you can think about whether you agree or disagree with the premises. Here's the first premise of the book. And this is really what motivated the book. We feel that the increasing inequality in income over the past 30 years in Canada, and particularly the increasing amount of national income that is being captured by the very, very rich, the top 1%, is the most profound change in our society, in our lifetimes. And indeed, that growing gap between the ultra-rich and everyone else will continue, it is now, and will continue to reshape virtually every aspect of our society to the great detriment of ordinary Canadians. It diminishes the well-being of us all, it tears at the fabric of our society, and it corrupts our democracy. And so basically, the rise of this upper rich class is enabling them to rewrite the terms of the social contract that served Canadians and Americans so well in that post-war period in the 40s, 50s, and the 1960s. They're in effect rewriting that contract in a way that in effect means that from now on the general social institutions will largely favor their interests. So we wrote the book because we're concerned that the kind of society we're becoming, namely a plutocracy, in which the rich have a vastly disproportionate influence over public policies and are, in effect, legislating largely in their own self-interest and, as I say, to the detriment, it seems to us, of ordinary Canadians. So that's really what motivated the book, our concern about this rising ultra-rich class. And basically our argument is that equality matters. And some people say we should only be concerned about inequality at the lower end of the income scale. We should only be concerned about bringing people up out of the poverty level. That's just wrong. A small number of very rich people are as great an obstacle to a flourishing society as a large number of poor people. And we take seriously the well-known words of the famous English social critic, Richard Taney, who said, "What thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people with equal justice call the problem of riches." Indeed, it's no coincidence that those countries that have the highest rates of poverty are also those countries with the highest degree of inequality at the high end of the income scale. The United States, for example, has by far the most billionaires in the world, and yet in the United States they have the highest rate of poverty of any industrialized country. Indeed, in the United States, over 20% of children live in families below the poverty line. There's just a basic immorality about that. But the point is, the fight against poverty can't be divorced from the underlying inequalities. So that's the first premise, that inequality matters, and it is, of course, an empirical, sociological premise, but it seems to me it would be hard to disagree with. The second premise is that over the last 30 years, while the percentage of families below the poverty line has remained stubbornly high, the wages of workers have stagnated, the rich have been getting much, much richer at everyone else's expense. And this is the case not only in Canada and the United States, but all Anglo-American countries. And the evidence of inequality at the top end is just everywhere. Most obviously, it's evidenced by the astronomical amounts paid to athletes and entertainers, hedge fund managers, investment specialists, chief executive officers, software entrepreneurs, and top earners in the professions like law and medicine. Most of those markets have become what we call winner-take-all markets, in which small numbers of people are making huge amounts. As I mentioned, the income in Canada of the median family, that is, if you just take the family that earns the amount of income right in the middle of the income distribution of income, so 50% people make more, families make more, 50% less. If you take the median family, the income of the median family in Canada has not gone up in real terms in 30 years. Back in 1975, in 2008 dollars, the median family was making about $45,000. That's about what they're making now. It's just stagnated over that whole period of time. But in the meantime, the income of high-income people has simply skyrocketed. In terms of billionaires, for example, from 1999 to 2009, the number of billionaires in Canada has more than doubled, from 25 to 55. Back in the 1960s, CEOs made about 20 times as much as the average worker. Now they make at least 200 times. That means, of course, that the average worker would have to work 200 years just to make the same amount as a CEO makes in 1 year. If someone is only earning minimum wages, they have to work 750 years to make the amount that a CEO makes in 1 year. Indeed, on average, the 10, if you just take the 10 top-paid CEOs, they make more than 900 times the average worker, which means someone working the minimum wage would have to work 2,483 years simply to make the same amount as those folks make in 1 year. Indeed, those folks make, the salaries they're drawing, they make on about $16,000 an hour, which means if they were here tonight at the end of this little talk, they'd have earned enough to go on a first-class trip all over the world, stopping at all the major cities. Whereas most of us at the end of this talk, we were lucky if we can go afford to go buy a beer and an aspirin or something. The differences are just huge, beyond imagination. And furthermore, of course, most of them are incompetent. Speaking of CEOs, I mean, and it turns out dishonest as well. I mean, I understand. I might forgive them for being incompetent. We're all a little incompetent, but it does seem to me to be pushing the envelope when you're both incompetent and dishonest. But the studies that we relied on, incidentally, primarily, and sort of talking about this increasing inequality, and I'm just going to take a minute to explain this because this is sort of so fundamental to both what motivated our book and also our recommendations, and just our understanding of what's happening in our world, is that over the last 10 years, there's been a bunch of public finance economists in a number of different countries that have been looking, using income tax data, using statistics from income tax, and in Canada, our income tax was passed back in 1917, and so they're collecting all that statistics from people who file tax returns from 1917 on, and are making estimates about, you know, what share of the national income is going to the top 1%, of course, or the top 0.1%. And so they've been conducting this over the last 10 years, and you'll see their studies referred to a lot in the book in most of the Anglo-American countries, And what they have found is that over the course of the 20th century in Anglo-American countries, that the degree of income inequality, again, we're talking here about at the top end, can be divided into four distinct periods. First of all is at the turn of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century is what we often refer to as the Gilded Age, where there was this upper class opulence and ostentatious displays of wealth, and everyone spoke of robber barons, and everyone understood the rich were ripping everyone else off. And in Canada during that period, say in the late 1920s, the top 1% were getting around 15 or 16% of the total income. 15 or 16% of the total income being earned in Canada went to people in the top 1%. And it's important to note that those families could accumulate that vast wealth at the time because there basically wasn't a progressive tax system. And there wasn't any wealth tax that was taxing people when they transferred wealth from one generation to the next. And so they were able to accumulate these vast fortunes. And then the second period is often referred to as the period of the Great Compression. It basically started the beginning of the 1930s until the end of World War II. And during that period, the share of national income going to the top 1% dropped dramatically. It went from about 15% down to 10%, about 10%. And partly, because of financial shocks and the war and so on, but also that we introduced really progressive taxes during that period. Indeed, during World War II, the top income tax rate on people earning what would be now over $3.5 million a year was 90%, you know. Those are what people like me refer to as the good old days. We had a serious tax system for people earning lots of money. And we introduced a wealth tax so that when rich people went to transfer their wealth from one generation to the next, the state took 50% of it. Indeed, those rates went up to 70% on wealth over a certain period. So there was this dramatic drop in it. Then, and here's the interesting part, then from 1945 right up until the end of the 1970s, the amount of national income going to the top 1% continued to decline. At the end of World War II, it was about 10%. By the end of the 1970s, it was about 70%. Throughout that whole period, we continued to become a more equal society. And let me just make two points about that. One point is, there isn't any question, and I think all economic historians agree with this, is that that continuing equality was brought about largely by government policy. Among other things, throughout that whole period, the top income tax rate in Canada was 80%. Again, it only applied to very rich people. People are earning over a million or so, but at 80%, it varied slightly, but around 80% throughout that whole, we had a wealth tax, so that wealthy families who tried to pass all of their wealth from one generation to the next paid a wealth tax. So it was largely government policy that was explaining that increasing equality. Secondly, that during this period, as our society was becoming more equal, I'm sure as you all know, we had our highest rates of economic growth we've ever had, lowest rates of unemployment. That is, there was just broad shared prosperity throughout that whole period. And indeed, in the 1960s, when I went to university and was growing up, the average person's standard of living was doubling every 17 years. Everyone could see they were going to be better off than their parents. And so it was a period of just sort of broad optimism, shared prosperity, and basically our society was becoming more equal. Then what happened, and I'm sure you all are familiar with this story, is beginning in the 1980s, and this is what we call now the Great Divergence. Beginning in the 1980s, the social contract that had guided Canada throughout that 30 years of shared prosperity began to unravel. And business interests, concerned that they were losing their privileged position in society, literally went on attack. They just launched a vicious, systematic, and comprehensive attack against the welfare state and began implementing what we widely refer to as the corporate agenda. Economic growth slowed, unemployment increased, but the rich began regaining their privileged position. Indeed, their share of income that they held during the Gilded Age. So by 2007, the top 1% were in effect now receiving over 14% of national income. That is, the amount of national income going to the top 1% literally doubled from 1980 to 2007. And the share going to the really rich, the top 0.01%, tripled over that period. The top 0.01% were getting about 1% of national income in 1980. They were getting almost 3% in 2007. And during that rate, income tax rates, of course, were going down. They went down from 70 to 60 to 50. And now in many provinces, somewhere between 40 and 45 is the top rate. And it kicks in at a very low income level. If you're earning $130,000 in most provinces, you're in the top income tax bracket. You pay the same marginal tax rate whether you're earning $130,000 or whether you're earning $1 million. So that our progressive tax system was just decimated. So that's the second premise, anyway, that over the past 30 years, there's been dramatic and unprecedented increase in inequality in the distribution of income and wealth. And no one disputes that. Well, except the people in the Financial Post. In fact, Linda and I got in a little exchange with a couple of the reporters from the National Post. They denied that there was increasing. But generally, no one in the reality-based community disputes those numbers. In fact, Linda wondered, what are they going to dispute next? Global warming? The third premise is that, so you got to agree, the first two aren't, equality matters, and we've had this dramatic increase in inequality at the high end. Here's the third premise. The causes of that increased inequality, some people say, well, the effect of all that income going to the rich, the top 1%, is just, it's an inevitable result of the way the world is changing. It's just the result of technological changes. It's the result of globalization. It's the result of the increased premium that skilled workers are able to demand. But we argue that's just wrong in the book. In fact, we argue instead it's the result of a long series of deliberate policy changes in government, policies that overwhelmingly favored the very rich. And those changes, in turn, were the result of increasingly sophisticated, well-financed, well-organized efforts by the corporate and financial sectors to, in effect, tilt government policies in their favor and thus favor the very wealthy. And those changes, including the deregulation of the financial industry, changes in corporate governance policies that allowed CEOs to basically set their own pay, changes in industrial relations policies that weaken labor unions, and most importantly, changes in the tax system that dramatically changed the wealthy. In short, inequality has nothing to do with the dictates of the market economy. It's the result of people at the top rigging the rules to their benefit. And they got government to stack the deck in their favor and then hire people like those working for the Fraser Institutes to try to tell other people it's just the natural working of the marketplace. In the book, we explain inequality as a function of power sustained by politics and implemented as policy. That's our third. The fourth premise is that the wealth and income of the rich is simply undeserved. I mean, they might argue, yeah, it's true. There's all this wealth going to wealthy people, but they deserve it. We argue there's no moral theory that would justify the vast incomes they receive. Indeed, given the enormous advantages and freedoms that income and wealth provides, this skewed distribution of income presents Canada with its most pressing, or one of its most pressing, moral issues. Those opposed to the use of progressive taxes often argue, as an instrument for redistributed income, argue that there's something inherently fair and just about the market distribution of income. That is, they start with the assumption that those top income people somehow deserve their good fortune, and they usually state that position rhetorically something like, it's my income, I earned it in a free market, the government has no right to take and redistribute it to others. There's two things that invalidate that position. One is, it's just conceptually incoherent. And there's no such thing as a free market. And the second one, even if it were conceptually coherent, it does not rest on a persuasive or any theory of distributive justice. First, it's conceptually incoherent since there's simply no such thing as a free market. And the rules of property contract and property law and contract law within which individuals earn their income, in fact, are as coercive as politically motivated and have even greater distributional consequences than the tax system. We lawyers call this the baseline problem. That is, there's just a whole bunch of laws out there. All of them are a result of political decisions. And so you can't sort of say, well, we're going to look at these laws and regard this as being our baseline as to what people are entitled to. And then any laws after that are taking away something they're entitled to. They're all laws that govern our interaction with one another, property laws, contract laws, all have distributional consequences, all are politically motivated. And so that it's just incoherent to try to argue that somehow people have entitlement to income they earn before the application of the tax system. I mean, what you're entitled to is what you've got after the application of all of those laws, including the tax system. There is actually a very nice section in the book on this, if I may say so, that I think makes this point sort of clearer than I've seen it made before, and it's just a profound point. But it has to do with, for example, a real simple example, like lawyers. We restrict admission to law schools, we give them monopoly over the practice of law, we don't allow, you know, immigrants to come in and join the law society and compete with them. We give them all this monopoly protection over the practice of law. which means that the practice of law tends to be much more lucrative than it otherwise would be. There's no question, as a result of all those regulations, lawyers make a lot more money than they would if we just let it rip. Again, there might be good reasons for those laws. We're protecting consumers of legal services and so on, but it's odd to argue that somehow that gives them a moral entitlement to that income, and that somehow then when you impose a tax on them, you're taking something, you're redistributing. I mean, we redistribute it up, you know, through all these regulations. And so all we're now trying to do is achieve a distribution of income that we think is morally acceptable through the tax system. We have this wonderful example in the book from Michael Caine in England. England, you might know, raised their top income tax rate from 40 to 50, and Michael Caine said he's going to leave England if they do that. He, you know, he's got all this hard-earned income that he makes as a movie star. He's going to leave England if they try to take his hard-earned income away from him. We point out he only got that income because of government regulations. He only got that income because we got copyright laws. That means when he makes a movie, other people got to pay to view it. And so he only got it because of government regulations. And we point out that if it wasn't for the copyright laws, he'd probably be making as much as any good porn movie actor would. Because in the porn business, you know, they don't enforce the copyright laws. And so some porn people, the people tell me, make a decent living, but none of them are millionaires, or, you know, none of them as much as Michael Caine makes. So he only makes that money because of government regulations. You've got a little chapter called The Porn Industry is the Only Real Free Market. And so some people say, well, yeah, but, you know, but if you didn't give them copyright protection, there wouldn't be innovation in movies and so on. I don't know about that. But people do tell me that in the porn industry, there's lots of innovation and lots of... But the whole point is just that there's a whole body of rules and protections that account for people's income, and it's odd to say, oh, yeah, but as a result of those, I have some entitlement you're taking away. We argue also in the book that generally these people don't deserve the income they receive because most of it is just due to luck, the accident of being born into a wealthy family, the accident of being born into a wealthy country. Pure accident. I mean, the one thing you've got no control over is who your parents are. And yet we know that has just a dramatic effect on how much income you will eventually earn. Just a dramatic effect. The good luck of investing in the right stock, the good luck of remaining able. So we argue that, you know, that these people, they're just, you know, they're lucky. Like they flip the coin 10 times and think they're clever. I mean, like here's the point I was going to make. If 1,000 people flipped a coin, right, flipping a coin, I think 3 of them would flip 10 heads in a row. But just pure, absolutely pure luck, right? But some of these fancy billionaires who flip 10 think it's due to their intelligence or hard work. It's just pure luck. Here, the fifth premise, that's, now I'll go through 1 minute on each one of these. The fifth one is this. They don't deserve it. Furthermore, the amount of income that they get is like having that relatively small number of rich people in a society is not a benign characteristic of a society. It greatly diminishes the quality of life of everyone else in the society. And we cite all sorts of studies that show that having that small group of very rich people up there leads to a reduction in social mobility. Indeed, if you're interested in social mobility, you have to be interested. Some people say, well, let's not worry about how much the rich are getting because people can sort of move up and down the income scale and we've got lots of social mobility. In fact, the evidence is that if you've got a high degree of inequality at the top end, it reduces social mobility in the society. Indeed, the United States, which has about the highest degree of inequality among the industrialized countries, also has the lowest degree of social mobility. Indeed, if you were in the United States today and you were interested in pursuing the American dream, my advice to you would be, you know, move to Norway. You will not get it in the States. Much more social mobility in equal countries. Unequal societies have a great increase in criminal violence and other forms of social disorder, reduced physical and mental health, reduced life expectancy, just a long litany of problems that are caused by this enormous inequality. We also, of course, contribute the financial crises to the inequality. Most importantly is just that it diminishes our democracy. And in the book, we go through all the subtle processes by which wealthy individuals are able to exert undue influence on public policy decision-making. The sixth premise is that the pursuit of a more equal society is not inconsistent with high levels of economic well-being. Lots of reasons for supporting that provided in the book. A quick answer, just look around the world. You will discover those societies which are most equal, like the Nordic countries, also tend to be the most economically competitive. Look at the historical evidence. You find that in those periods of Canadian history, when we had the greatest degree of equality, we also had the fastest rates of economic growth lowest rates of unemployment. We provide, and then finally, what we argue in the book, the last premise is that if we really want to do something to reduce the inequality in our society, particularly the amount of national income going to the, but you've got to use the tax system. And we make an argument as to why the tax system is the most effective policy instrument. Among other things, you can target it at the top 1% very easily through progressive income taxes and a wealth taxes. It's much more, it can be effective immediately. Some people say, oh, well, let's just improve our educational system. Well, come and see me in 40 years. Maybe we can improve it. It will make a difference. But by then it'll be too late. So we say, look, we should operate on all fronts to remove inequality, but the tax system is essential. So in conclusion, the argument in the book is not about bashing the rich simply because they're rich. It's about deciding in what kind of a society Canadians aspire to live in. And the social contract we think that most Canadians are in favor of is one that is premised on the assumption that each of us is born with an equal moral worth and entitlement to dignity and to the rights of citizenship, that choices individuals make as citizens participating and voting in democracies, democratic procedures are as important as the choices we make as consumers, that our greatest achievements as a society are the product not of individual endeavor, but of community and collective efforts, that freedom involves the power to make choices about how one lives, that most people are essentially alike, with minor differences that are often interesting, that all Canadians, rich or poor, have a shared destiny, that we're all in the same boat together, and that the quality of our lives should not be measured by the lifestyles of the rich, but by the legitimate aspirations of every individual. And that is both just and feasible that everyone is entitled to a fair share of what we collectively produce, but only a fair share. Now, those who oppose our proposals we make in the book will likely say that lower taxes on the rich is not a matter of political choice, but an economic imperative. That's profoundly wrong. It's contradicted by theory, by empirical evidence, but most importantly, simply by our experience and our common sense. Canadians still do have a good deal of choice in deciding what kind of society that they want to live in, and choosing that society remains a political and deeply moral issue. Lately, the business interest has lamented the terrible legacy we're leaving in our children in the form of a national debt. In fact, the much worse legacy we are in danger of leaving them if we continue to allow the corporate agenda to be implemented, if we continue to diminish the progressivity of our tax system and the role of government in our lives, is a society in which resources are distributed in an obscenely unequal way, a society in which the relevant standard of living of the average family continues to stagnate, a society without a sense of itself or a sense of its collective responsibility, and a society in which the economic elite is ever more able to defend itself politically. That, the book argues, would be a truly unjust, a truly irresponsible legacy for us to leave to the next generation. Hopefully someday, because of books like this and work being done by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and other resources, Canadians will once again demand that their political parties have enough heart, have enough intelligence, and have enough courage to stand up and openly confront the power of the plutocracy. Thank you very much.
You have just heard Professor Neil Brooks speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on November 3, 2010, about his new co-author book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Next up, best-selling author and business columnist and co-author, Linda McQuaig.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Should society be more equal, more fair in the distribution of wealth created by a whole civilization in which we and all our ancestors have built? Or should billionaires run the whole show? This week on Radio EcoShock, we hear from two authors of the new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Our next speaker is co-author Linda McQuaig. She's a longtime business columnist, author of a string of Canadian bestsellers, and social critic. She questions why Bill Gates or any billionaire should have money worth many times the life work of the average person, and why have the rich taken over since the 1980s? We'll cut in as McQuaig talks about the former media baron and now jailhouse resident Conrad Black, who once suggested Linda should be, quote, horsewhipped. Black later hired McQuaig as a financial journalist at his newspaper, The Financial Post.
Now, I think you're probably expecting I'm going to go on and say some nasty things about Conrad Black, you know. And I have done that at various points in my life, but actually tonight I want to say something nice about Conrad Black. Yeah, you know, it's absolutely true that he has spent his whole life fighting against social justice, but I think he gives us hope because he's living proof that even a rich right-wing jerk can end up in jail, and that shows social justice is possible. I should point out, there are other books out there about the rise of the new rich, but they're a little bit different. They're often sort of all about how glamorous and exciting the lives of the rich are. And amazingly, you know, even in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008, we're still getting that kind of book. You know, there's a new book out about John Paulson. You know, he's that hedge fund manager who made $3.7 billion betting against the subprime mortgage market, you know, giving him the all-time record in history for profiting from the misery of others. Because really, his bet, his trade, as they call it, helped trigger the financial crisis with all the, of course, horrible repercussions that we're all still experiencing from that. Now, you might expect a journalist writing a book about this guy would have some critical things to say. But surprisingly, this book is extremely positive. He's portrayed as a hero. You get a sense from the title. It's written by a Wall Street Journal reporter, and the title of it is The Greatest Trade Ever. But, you know, that may be the view on Wall Street and on Bay Street and places like that. But our sense is that among ordinary people, the view is probably closer to those protesters who march down Wall Street carrying a placard saying, "Jump, you fuckers." So I guess I just want to clarify that you know, our book is more in the kind of "jump, you fuckers" genre of books about the rich. The extreme level of inequality that we see today, this incredible rise of income at the top, while the rest of the population has really been stagnant, I think that Canadians, by and large, don't really know that story. You know, essentially what's happened is all the income growth in the last three decades has gone to the top. It's gone to the top 10%, but it's particularly gone to the top 1%. And the higher up within that 1% you go, the bigger the economic gains are. So, for instance, 30 years ago, the average CEO typically had an income that was 20 to 30 times the average wage. Today, that gap is that the average CEO has an income that's roughly 200 to 300 times the average wage. The top hedge fund managers in the financial business, you know, the gap is even more extreme. For instance, here's one statistic that always stuns me. In 2009, like that's after the financial crash, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned on average, $1 billion each. Okay? And that, by the way, is not 200 or 300 times the average wage. That is 24,000 times the average wage. And by the way, some of these numbers are American. The case has been most extreme in the United States, but it has been very much the case here in Canada as well. In the last dozen years in Canada, for instance, while the incomes of ordinary people have been stagnant, and you may not feel that the incomes are stagnant, but you probably do feel that they're stagnant. But in case you're doubting that, don't forget that people in the middle class are basically working twice as hard as they did earlier, because of course they have two incomes, whereas 30 years ago was not unusual to have a single family income, or one income for a family. Anyway, while this has basically been stagnant among ordinary people, in Canada in the past dozen years, the incomes of the top 50 CEOs have risen on average by 440%. Just a staggering increase at the top. And our sense, and I'm sure you got this clearly from Niels, our sense is this is just a dramatic change. This is a dramatic change that cries out for some kind of justification. You know, you fundamentally change how money is distributed among the people in society, and nobody kind of even comments on it. And you raise it and you're considered some kind of weird radical or something. We think it absolutely cries out for justification. Now, to the extent that there is a justification out there in the business press, it tends to be that the people at the top have to have these big incentives, right? They have to have the incentives so they will perform to optimal capacity. That this is really necessary for the success of our economy. So you would think, given the huge rewards at the top, that the performance must be just staggering. I think you know where I'm going with this. Let's just give you a couple of quick fun examples. That in 2009, after the terrible financial crash, the head of Merrill Lynch gave their top executives $4 billion worth of bonuses. This is right after this top team had just steered the company to $29 billion in losses. And I think some reporter asked him, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, well, we have to do this to keep our most talented people. Which makes you wonder what some of the less talented people they had might have done. But our point is that when you look through the evidence, there's just simply no evidence of a justification for this enormous run-up at the top. Today's top earners are not more talented, they're not more creative, they're not more hardworking than the top earners were 30 years ago. They're not worth 300 times, 200 or 300 times what the average income person is working. They're certainly not worth 24,000 times what the average worker is earning. In fact, we argue that there's no justification. What basically has happened is there's been simply a kind of a coup. That, in effect, what's happened is, you know, this concentration of income at the top, this huge income, is the result of a, you know, massive, masterful political campaign, basically to get more for themselves. And how did they do it? Well, you know what? I'm going to throw in a list here. Okay? Well, I'm just going to quickly say that, Neil, four items I want to draw your attention to. Basically, this is our point, that it's not something haphazard. It's a deliberate campaign. And we identify, for instance, changes in CEO compensation, stock options principally, very, very key factor in driving up wages. Changes in ideology, the ideology of neoliberalism that basically encouraged the encouragement of greed and accumulation at the top and the kind of tolerance for greed in society, which was not the case 30 years ago. Changes, very crucial changes in the tax system that drove taxes down for people at the upper end. And also, fourthly, the changes that have disempowered labor, because by disempowering labor, that is empowered capital and has allowed capital to basically trample on the rights of so many working people. And so what we argue basically is that this enormous concentration of wealth at the top, it's kind of a scam really what's happened. And partly the reason it's a scam is because they haven't been honest. You know, the group at the top that have orchestrated this big change, it's not as if they came out and said, well, you know, we're greedy. We would like more. They don't say that. Instead, they couch it in terms of it's an economic necessity. You have to do this. You have to cut taxes on the rich. If you don't cut taxes on the rich, you will destroy the economic performance of your country. You'll gut economic growth. You'll limit economic growth. And therefore, in the interest of all of us, we have to cut taxes on the rich. That's the way they sold it to us. Well, as Neil has pointed out, next time somebody makes that argument to you, one of the things you can say is, well, after you say, go Flames, go, you know, then the next thing you say is that, in fact, high taxes, there's no evidence that high taxes actually do anything to destroy economic growth. Because, in fact, if you look at that post-war period, 1945 to 1980, the taxes on the rich, as Niels mentioned, were incredibly high. The marginal tax rates were 80 and 90%, both in Canada and the United States. And yet, both in Canada and the United States, those were the periods of greatest economic growth in our countries. There were vibrant capitalist economies. So you cannot argue that the high taxes destroyed economic growth. It is simply refuted by the evidence. And in fact, strikingly, since the taxes have been reduced since 1980, and they have been dramatically reduced since 1980, you know, we mentioned there was marginal tax rates as high as 80 and 90 to, in fact, above 90% some years, they're now down to the top marginal tax rate is 46%. Dramatic reduction. And yet, since that's happened, economic growth has slowed down as well. So the lower taxes since 1980 have not produced the big cornucopia that we're always told about. Now, the other big argument, of course, they always come out with is that if you have high tax on the rich, they'll leave, right? They'll leave. Well, you know, I was going to say, you know, when people say that, and your point is, you know. But, you know, this is actually a huge topic, and since Neil talks so long, I don't really have the time to get into it. But let me just say, some will go. They will, and they'll be very noisy when they go. The truth is, most won't go, because most people actually make decisions in their lives for more reasons than just the rate of tax. You know, they like to live in a country because their family's here, their friends, whatever. We actually have some interesting arguments in the book about how to deal with the problem of tax havens. But, and maybe we can talk about that in the question period, but I won't get into that now. But I guess the real point I wanted to make is just simply to raise the point. It's interesting the way we just let them hold us hostage like that. I mean, imagine if another group in society, not the rich, another group, let's say plumbers, you know, or electricians or something, threatened to leave the country unless we did exactly what they wanted. You know, would we immediately kind of submit to them and just do what they wanted? I mean, it just seems a curious kind of approach that we don't think, isn't this odd that we're being demanded to do these things? And if we don't, you know, they're going to threaten to leave, and that we sort of think, well, then we better do it. I have this whole thing I want to talk about, why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his fortune. But I think maybe I don't have time. Do I have time? Or,
yeah.
Oh, geez, not many Bill Gates fans here tonight. Okay. Well, all right. What I want to say then is that today's concentration of income at the top is a reflection of what we called, or what could be called, the great man theory, right? The idea that, you know, there's certain individuals who are just so talented and so much better than the rest of us that kind of all by themselves they make great things happen. And, you know, if they were to leave the country, we'd barely be able to figure out how to turn the lights on. And this notion is therefore, you know, that because these people are so talented, they really deserve their billions. And in fact, this kind of theory is often advanced by billionaires. So for instance, here's just a couple of billionaires. Here's Leo Hendry, who invented a sports cable TV network. He said, "I think there are some people, including myself, who are, because of their uniqueness, warrant whatever the market will bear." One of the things I like about billionaires is their modesty. Or here's Sanford Vail, a big Wall Street tycoon. He says, "In the last 25 years, the last 25 years is an incredibly unique period. We didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built. We did it ourselves." Really, really, really. That's an interesting thought. So in other words, if Sanford Vail had been abandoned at birth on a desert island, he would have built his fortune up, goddamn, exactly the same way that he did, right? Well, maybe not. And so the interesting thing is that, you know, we would argue that if he could build up that fortune all by himself, abandoned on a desert island, then he should be able to keep every single bit of it. because he did it all himself. But if he couldn't reproduce it all on his own, then I think it's reasonable to ask the question, how much did he create and how much did other people create? Because the great man theory always leaves out the role of society, right? It always leaves out the role of every other person in the great man's life. The people that nurtured that person, that educated him, that created the society that allowed him to thrive. And most crucially, what it leaves out is the technological inheritance from the past that enabled his breakthrough to happen. And so here we come to Bill Gates. Now, Bill Gates is credited with inventing the operating system of the personal computer. But that was only possible because of all the advances that had happened before that. In fact, the computer itself had already been invented by the time Bill Gates was born. So every advance that led to the development of the computer and every advance before that, going all the way back to the beginning of, you know, the invention of the wheel, every advance builds on the other. And the truth is, Bill Gates could never, of course, have invented the personal computer if all those advances hadn't come before. So the notion, you know, we didn't really rely on somebody else, we did it all ourselves, it's just ludicrous. Every individual relies on thousands of individuals in society and historically many more tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. In fact, it's been calculated that this technological inheritance is responsible for something like 90% of the wealth that's generated today. It's just an immense inheritance. So the question is, who does that inheritance belong to? Who should be the beneficiary of all that technological development from the past? Well, under our current system, Bill Gates gets virtually all the benefits from the personal computer, even though he only really was involved in the very last stage of the development. Oh, and by the way, here's another kind of cute irony. Bill Gates actually didn't invent the operating device of the personal computer. Actually, it was another guy. It was Gary Kildall. And Bill Gates knew Gary Kildall, but he managed to kind of elbow him out of the way and get the contract with IBM instead. And in fact, that kind of thing is typical, because the way science works is that one advance leads to another, and when a scientific breakthrough happens, the next stage is kind of obvious and more or less inevitable to the relatively small number of people that are working in that field. So with or without Bill Gates, we would have had the personal computer. We would have had it because of the technological inheritance from the past. So the point is, why should $53 billion be in Bill Gates' pocket rather than sharing a larger amount of that through taxation with society at large? And we have in the book a number of ideas about how we can increase the taxes. And, you know, again, when you say this kind of thing, when you talk about increasing taxes on the rich, for instance, we suggest that there should be a new top marginal tax rate for incomes above $500,000. So probably not too many people in the room are going to be affected by that. But there are a number of Canadians making over $500,000 a year, and we think they should, once they reach $500,000, income above that should be taxed at the rate of 60%. And we think that with incomes above $2.5 million, and by the way, there's about 5,000 Canadians making $2.5 million a year, 59,000 making $500,000 a year, we think anything above $2.5 million should be taxed at 70%. Now, maybe that sounds onerous. If we have a choice, if we have to raise taxes on the rich, raise taxes on the rest of the population, or let government services decline because we don't have enough tax revenue, and therefore punish all the bulk of the population that relies on those programs, if we have those three choices, is raising taxes on the rich such an unreasonable one? I do want to quickly tell you one idea that we have for tax change that I think is really exciting, and I think you will find it exciting too, and that is to introduce an inheritance tax. We don't have an inheritance tax in Canada. We used to. It was quietly canceled in 1972. And we're one of the few countries in the Western world that doesn't have one. Okay, so what we propose is that inheritance is bigger. You could inherit up to $1.5 million and pay no tax at all. So only going to be the top 1% that are affected by this, okay? So think about it. You get to get $1.5 million without paying any tax, which is interesting when you think about it, because when you earn income up to $1.5 million, you pay lots of tax on it, but we're going to give you an exemption on that first $1.5 million, which is unearned income. I mean, it's due to no skill, no talent, no effort on your part, only the skill of choosing the appropriate parents. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett has called this the ovarian lottery. And I think that's a suitable... But anyway, the exciting part of this is that once we get that money from the taxing people, you know, the top 1% inheritances, there will be enough revenue that we'll be able to set up educational trust funds for every Canadian child. So when every child turns 16, they will have $16,000 deposited into an educational trust fund to be used exclusively for education or training of that child. And you know, we just and in addition to what that will do for national productivity, it will simply do wonders for the notion that this is a inclusive community, that we care about people in our community, and that we actually believe in a concept like equality of opportunity. I think I'm going to wrap up here, but I want to leave you with some good news, okay? Because, you know, sometimes this seems a little down to be thinking of how, you know, how much the rich have gotten richer and how bad Neil's career is. And, but this is some very good news. And that is ordinary people, not even just people in this room, but even ordinary people out there, actually care about equality to a surprising extent. And the evidence I want to point to is there's an interesting study that just came out that was done by a couple of professors at Harvard. And they interviewed thousands, something like 5,000 typical Americans, randomly selected. Rich, poor, fat, thin, Republican, Democrat, everything. And there's a couple of things. One of the things they found, the issue they were interviewing them about was to do with inequality and distribution of wealth, okay? And the first thing they discovered is that Americans have absolutely no sense of how actually unequal their country is. They just have no sense whatsoever. And as the Harvard guys pointed out in here, even there were some economists that had been randomly selected, and they had no idea whatsoever either. So that's the first thing, that the actual level of inequality is unknown. But here's the really intriguing thing. Then the second part of the study was to determine, well, what would they like? What would Americans like to have as the level of inequality in their society? Like, how would they like the shares of the national income to be distributed among different segments of the population? And they did this in an intriguing way. They drew up sort of three, I guess you could call them pie charts, okay? And they just labeled them pie A, pie B, and pie C. Pie A was, although they didn't know this, the people doing this didn't know, like the Harvard people knew, but the ordinary people didn't know. Pi A represented the actual distribution of wealth in the United States. So very unequal, okay? Pi B represented the actual distribution of wealth in Sweden, okay? Pi C showed total equality. Well, you know what? It turned out 90% of the Americans, randomly selected, rich, poor, fat, thin, everything, selected as their preferred choice of how wealth should be distributed, pie B, Sweden. Of course, they didn't know it was Sweden. If they'd known it was Sweden, they would have rejected it. It would be socialism, and, you know. and they wouldn't have anything to do with it. But that is the reality. 90% actually favored that fair a distribution of income. Now, that's an American study. But if anything, I think Canada would probably even more that way. And I do have a little bit, just quickly, to say about Canada. You know, there is lots of evidence that Canadians do care deeply about social programs and care about social programs more than tax cuts. Sure, if you ask them, do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? You know, they say, yeah, I do. But if you force them to choose, if you say, do you want a tax cut or do you want social reinvestment? Do you want your money spent reinvested in health care, education, pensions, etc.? Overwhelmingly, by margins, actually above 80%, Canadians will tell you they want social reinvestment. You know, and this is maybe a little surprising, because we tend to think, you know, if you just observe what's going on out there, you tend to think from reading the media that everybody out there is suffering from tax rage. You know, it turns out, in fact, very, very few Canadians are actually suffering from tax rage. In fact, I can tell you, it's really just a small group. It's rich older men. And I actually have some evidence to back this up. I'm not just making that accusation. My evidence is, there's a publication that comes out in the National Post from time to time. It's a weird little publication. It's called The Wealthy Boomer. A very strange publication. It consists of just two things: articles about tax rage and ads for Viagra. You know, which leads me to wonder, you know, does tax rage cause erectile dysfunction? Or does erectile dysfunction cause tax rage? But anyway, my point is that the right is impotent. Actually, sadly, that is not true. The right is not impotent. But my real point is, neither are we. And the point is that it's time that we actually started standing up and fighting to make this a more equal society. Thank you very much.
Radio EcoShock.
That was The Thorn in the Side of the Wealthy, journalist and author Linda McQuaig. She was speaking at the Vancouver Public Library with tax professor Neil Brooks to announce their new book, The Trouble with Billionaires: Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
Its purpose, to defend human freedom against COBRA, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
He never gives up. He'll stay till the
most disgusting and outrageous act of financial terrorism we've seen in decades. And I'm speaking, of course, of the central banks inflating the money supply.
One of the problems we have now in not having a recovery is that all the money is up there at the top. There is not enough money out there in general circulation. And as long as you have that population, you know, the general population without money in their pockets, going to spend and buy things, businesses are not interested in investing. So if nothing more, in order to stimulate economic growth, get the economy moving, we need to redistribute. We can't just have the money concentrated at the top.
The other half is to reclaim our democracy and social justice. My thanks to the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives for organizing this event and allowing me to record it. Find out more about them at policyalternatives.ca. You can download the full speeches by Brooks and McQuaig, plus the question and answer period, as free MP3 files. Look for Economy in our audio on demand menu at our website, ecoshock.org. We'll close out with a little thing from California songwriter Dana Pearson. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for caring about our world.
The billionaire polluters. Billionaire polluters. Destroying everything.
Destroy, destroy, destroy.
The billionaire polluters. Destroying everything.
Destroy, destroy, destroy.
Why do you
and never